In aviation, when you are testing the radio working in an airplane, we call the air traffic control, how do you read? And then they say, I read U5. That means that the signal is very, very well. And when you say, I read U2, it's fucked up, the signal. You cannot hear anything when you say, I read U2. So how do you read me now?
Born in Bad Gastein, nestled in the middle of Austria, Gerald Lehne began a lifelong journey from the alpine peaks of Central Europe to the high-altitude vistas of the Himalayas, the windswept terrains of Alaska, and countless other places around the world. As a teacher and engineer, Lehne was able to contribute directly to the communities that welcomed him. As a journalist for major news publications like ORF, Profile, and Der Spiegel, he supported his hosts by sharing their stories with global audiences thousands of miles away.
I have grown up in the valley of Gastein. That's a high mountain valley, 100 kilometers, approximately 60 miles, south of the city of Salzburg, in the high mountains of the Alps. It's the main chain of the high Alps between the Austrian provinces of Salzburg and Carinthia. And we in the Gastein valley are on the Salzburg side of the high mountains. I'm coming from a working class family. My father was a power plant worker in the Gastein Valley, and my mother was a housewife, but she was a bookkeeper too for a small business, and I'm a solo kid. I have no sisters. I was growing up in a working class settlement in the mountains. It's quite a narrow valley. When you go up to the mountains, it's very, very beautiful. And there is the decision for every man or woman or kid in the Gastein Valley. You can become a mountaineer, a skier, or an alcoholic, or commit suicide. So it's very, very hard to live in this valley without doing mountain sports. You know, the living conditions at that time, 20 years after Second World War, it was quite, in comparison to today, a poor surrounding, a poor environment, a working class environment. But we had the advantage that we had a wonderful mountain area around us. So in the morning, my mother said, okay, you have to be back in the evening at 6 o'clock. And so we had the whole day to go out, have our adventures, playing Indians and cowboys in the woods, in the mountains. You know, in school, I had some girls in the same classroom, and they were the daughters of a mountain farmer. So I could go with them, even in primary school, and look for the cattle, for the cows, the goats. So it's not really a working class childhood like maybe in a big city in America or in Germany or in Vienna in Austria. It was a working class childhood in the mountains, and that's very, very special when I look at the children, how they have to spend their childhoods today. Every time controlled by mobile phone, every time controlled by their parents. We had no control. We were wild kids. No, it was not only amazing, you know, we were quite, little monsters sometimes, because Bad Gastein, there are many tourists and people who go there because there are hot springs, and some older people go there from all over Europe to heal their diseases. And there are promenades in the mountains and along the rivers, and we were little Indians, and we were collecting these coons. Unbelievable what we did as kids, you know. We went to the forests and burning firewood of foreign people. And
family members are our first exposure to the many perspectives and personalities we'll encounter in the world. Through these relationships, we begin to form our own understanding of value and personal approach to life.
My father was a strong mountaineer when he was young, but he married a woman from the flatter parts of Austria. She came from Upper Austria. He was very much in love with her, and he stopped his hard mountaineering because of her. And then she became pregnant. And, you know, my father, I had always the feeling that he could understand what I did, but he was too weak to resist against her because she was very much afraid of it, that her son is doing such hard mountain sports. You know, my father, he was 40 when I was born, and he was a prisoner of war in Second World War in the United States. And he was quite an open-minded guy, but he, in comparison to my mother, he was much too weak. And he tried to influence me with a positive picture of the United States and a positive picture of travel. My mom always was a little bit afraid that I would do too dangerous things. She didn't like the danger of it. She came from a flat territory in Austria, and she never learned skiing well. So even skiing for herself was quite a torture. And my father took me skiing when I was 2.5 years old. I did my first skiing when I was really a little child, and I was loving it. And my father was a strong skier, and he was even a ski jumper in his youth, and he was a total fanatic skier. This was quite amazing that he was teaching me skiing when I was such a little kid. I remember most of my father teaching me skiing and teaching me about the United States, that this is a positive country and the Americans are good people, that in Nebraska and South Dakota there are beautiful landscapes and nice farmers, and that they were taking care for him very well when he was a prisoner of war. And if the German Nazis had treated if they were treated in America as POWs, like the Nazis treated their POWs, he would have been killed, and I never would have seen the light of this earth. I never would have been born because he would have been killed in America. So he was very thankful and grateful for the United States. That as a young man, you know, he never was a Nazi. He was much too young, and he was no member of the Nazi party. He was born in 1922, and American troops captured him in France when he was 22 in 1944. And so they had to go to New York and then several days to the west, to Nebraska, South Dakota. And he spent 4 years in the States as a prisoner of war. And he did not want to go back at that time, but he had to go back to Austria. He wanted to become an American, but this was impossible for prisoners of war to stay and become American. When he was turning 75, I was going with him to the United States, and we went via New York to Denver, Colorado, and had a rental car, and we visited the farms in the Midwest where he had to work as a young man. He told me many stories about the time as a prisoner of war, and we went to Fort Robinson. This is in Nebraska, and Fort Robinson was a famous place of the United States cavalry. And it was very amazing for me to go with him to Fort Robinson. And there was a historian, the Nebraska State Historical Society. And this guy was very happy that we came along, and he did an interview with my father as a witness of the time. So I remember it very well. And then we continued from Nebraska to South Dakota to the Black Hills. There is a village, it's called Belle Fouche. It was founded by French settlers, I think, in the 19th century. And there was the farmer of a family. The family name was Stark. And we could find the farm, and the farmer at that time was an old man like my father, but he could remember my father because as young men, they together had to work in the fields of the farm. And he was quite amazed too that a former prisoner of war was coming back and visiting the family. So my family was a typical Austrian family. On my father's side, the tradition was very left-wing. My father was a social democrat, not very left, but his father was a communist. You have to imagine at that time, maybe in 1918, nobody in Europe could ever imagine what communism would be in the future. And my grandfather, the father of my father, he was a prisoner of war, of First World War, of the Austrian army in Siberia. And he was at Krasnoyarsk, a prisoner of war camp in Siberia. And my grandfather learned to know Lenin, Vladimir Ulyanov himself, because the Bolshevists, after the revolution, they traveled to Siberia and they tried to find Austrian and German technicians or good workers to stay in the Soviet Union to build up socialism. And my grandfather came back from Siberia as a communist. And my grandmother was a very, very strong, the mother of my father was a very, very strong Catholic. And he tried, my grandfather tried to force her to go to the Soviet Union to build up socialism together. And my grandmother was totally angry and crazy about this. And she resisted, and she never would have gone to the Soviet Union. And she told him that. And in the next step, she became pregnant in 1921. And so this was the decision in 1922. My father was born, and my grandfather could not go to the Soviet Union. Quite a nice story, because maybe if they had gone, they would have been killed in the 30s, like many Austrians and German people, who communists who went to the Soviet Union. Stalin killed all of them, as you know, maybe in the States. This is quite nice. And on my mother's side, my grandfather on my mother's side was a Nazi, a very authoritarian low-level Nazi in Upper Austria. That's the flat part of Austria. I remember him very badly, because when I was a young child, he was totally authoritarian against me even. And he had all these behavings, how you think Nazis behave, you know. And my mother was even a solo kid of her father. And I think she had not a good childhood with this guy, with 86 years. And I asked him, why did my grandmother marry this bullshit Nazi guy, you know? And he said, well, look at the age of her. She was very, very young, and he was 11 years older than her, and she became pregnant. And at that time, the only solution for a young lady was to marry the man making her pregnant, you know?
As young adults, we stand at the precipice of possibility, eager to explore the vast expanse of the world before us. It's a time when wanderlust beckons us forward, promising stories from distant lands and untold adventures.
When I was 14, I had to leave the valley and go to a bigger city 70 kilometers away, and it was an engineering school. And we have the system here in Austria that you can become a small-scale engineer when you visit the engineering school, and it's from 14 to 19 to the age of 19, and it's a very hard school for young people. We had 40 hours every week, and I did mechanical engineering, and so I became, my parents, they were very happy that I decided to become an engineer and not a normal worker. So for me, I'm the first member of my family who went to an engineering school. It's some kind of special high school in Austria. We call it Höhere Technische Bundeslehranstalt. When you're finished with 19, 20 years, you can work as a mechanical engineer. And if you want, you can go to the university, study mechanical engineering. I decided to work 1 or 2 years in an engineering company. You know, at that time, I was a very strong mountain climber. Some kind of resistance of myself in my revolutionary years, maybe from 17th year, to go rock climbing, to go ice climbing, to do dangerous things in the mountains. And I had contact to some quite famous Himalayan climbers, and they had a nice program for young people, so we could go with them to the mountains, and they infected us with their sickness for the mountains.
The mountains and extreme terrains of the Alps are deeply alluring for all kinds of athletes. For young Gerald's mother, his connection with these alpine sports was endlessly worrisome.
And I was shocking my surrounding and my parents by doing mountain sports and climbing up frozen waterfalls, ice climbing. And my mother hated it, you know. She tried to put me in prison back home, but it was very hard to do that. It was very hard for me the first 2 years to go away from home with 14 years. I was so homesick, and every weekend, as fast as I could, I went back to see my mother, to see my father. Then when I became a mountaineer and had the contact and friendship with these older Himalaya people, maybe my people back home did not see me for 2 months because I spent every weekend in the mountains. And as a teenager, when I was 18, I had a relationship with an older woman. She was 35, and it was quite a wild time. Mountain climbing, running. I did a lot of running and cross country skiing. And even my first sexual experiences are connected to Saalfelden. So watch it from a psychoanalytic point of view. It had to do with a strong relationship with my mother, because she had a very strong relationship to me, and I thought she would be so unhappy that I'm not here anymore. And it was even sometimes maybe some kind of manipulation of her sometimes. When you're the only child of a family, it's harder sometimes in comparison to people who are two or three children. Some kind of symbiotic relationship a little bit with my mother. It had to do even with the sickness. When I was four or five years old, I had a strong asthma. Even the doctors were thinking when I was 4 or 5 years old that I could be killed by asthma. So my parents tried to bring me to the Adriatic Sea in Italy. And at that time, not every child in Austria or in Salzburg could go to the sea or to the ocean, because it was too expensive for the workers class to travel to Italy. My parents, they spent some money, I think sometimes a lot of money. So every summer we traveled to Italy together, and so my asthma disappeared. This is even the reason, one of the reasons that I'm doing what I'm doing until today. I'm still looking for love and freedom. I think love and freedom belong to each other. Even in relationships with women or with a woman, and there is no freedom without love, and there is no love without freedom. I'm convinced that you should accept people and what they are doing and what they want to do, and not try to change them all the time. And this was a very, very strong force in my childhood and youth, that my parents often tried to change me. I know today that if you try to change somebody, it turns completely in a different direction.
Often when we lack direct control over an aspect of our life, personal philosophy and spirituality act as methods to cope with the struggle. Far from home among Himalayan peaks, this was no different for Gerald.
In the area of the Mount Everest, there are people with Tibetan roots living, but on the Nepali side of the Mount Everest, and it belongs to Nepal. And there is a big Buddhist monastery, it's called Tengpoche. And I was doing small hydropower station engineering in the area, and we had two Austrian projects, but monastery Tengpoche had at that time an American small hydropower station. And my friend Broughton Coburn from Wyoming, he was the engineer and social worker at this monastery. He had to go back to Wyoming because his wife got a baby, and so I had to take over the American project. And I was repairing the small hydropower station of the Buddhist monastery. And I remember my mother was suffering very much with her cancer, and I was going to a Tibetan monastery and asking him, please help me spiritually to save my mother and to save her life. It was quite a nice experience, because he was happy that I repaired their small hydropower station, but on the other hand, he could do nothing for my mother because I'm laughing now, because it's very naive to believe to fight cancer with Buddhist puchas in the Himalayas. I was working in a small company as a mechanical engineer, and it was very, very boring to me to spend 9 to 5 in the engineering room and drawing bullshit machinery and tools and everything. So on one weekend, we were climbing a big mountain in the Großglockner area, and we had to go up to a mountain hut and sleep there and stay there. And there I learned to know a young, it was not a young lady, she was older than me too. I loved older, I loved girls who were older than me at that time. and Heidi was her name, freshly divorced, had two young children, and she was 32 and I was 23 or something. Yeah, we fell in love, and I was working on this mountain hut then every summer and was running it together with her. And beside that, I was studying at the university political sciences and history. So I did some studies too to become a primary school teacher, but I never have taught little children because the really crazy people in schools often are the parents. So I decided not to become primary school teacher. But I could teach in primary schools, I can show you, I have the certification. But when I was finishing my primary school certification, a good friend of mine and me, we went to Eastern Turkey, Northern Iraq and Northern Iran for ski mountaineering. And it was a very big adventure. And it was the time when the first Kurdish war broke out, you know, when the Turkish army was fighting Iraq, Kurdistan. And we were ski mountaineering there and nearly shot by a Turkish military patrol because they thought we would be a Kurdish terrorist group. And the sergeant of the Turkish platoon, he was checking for one more time, who are these crazy guys? They could not be Kurdish terrorists because they are wearing skis and rucksacks and colorful rucksacks. So he was checking it, and this saved our lives because otherwise the Turkish patrol would have shot us. So they saved our life.
Although his career began with engineering, Gerald's natural propensity to adventure and uncover rich stories would ultimately lead him down another professional path.
I was calling my mother back home on the telephone, and it was quite difficult to call from northern Iraq, from the mountains to Austria, but I could call from the Turkish side of the mountains. Shortly before we went to Kurdistan for ski mountaineering, I read in the newspaper that Austrian Broadcasting Corporation would be looking for young reporters and young journalists, and people should send in some reports and stories and stuff. And I had written to them and sent some adventures from mountaineering. And my mother on the telephone told me that the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation was calling and writing that I should call them because they would be interested that I would join the young reporter staff or something. So I called Austrian Broadcasting Corporation from Kurdistan, and the editor-in-chief, he was totally surprised that one of his future young reporters is calling from Kurdistan. And I told him the story that we nearly were shot in this Kurdish-Turkish war. And then he gave me the number of the central unit of Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, and they were doing an interview with me about this experience. And from that time, when I came back to Austria, from that time I was a freelance reporter of Austrian Broadcasting Corporation. I never thought at that time that it would change my life totally, then this would be the first profession I would do all of my life. So this was quite an interesting thing with Kurdistan. I always was interested in writing, and even on the engineering school, my companions had big problems with German language and writing reports. They hated German and literature as in a general, and I always loved this stuff too. I was good in arithmetic and in physics and in the technical fields too, but on the other hand, I loved it very much. Read literature and write a little bit. So writing was always in my interest, but journalism never. And I spent many, many years as a freelancer. Was not paid well, but you are satisfied and sometimes proud when you produce good stories for them. And I spent a lot of time in the United States and in Canada and in Asia to produce and do research for good stories. On the other hand, I'm the biographer of the Austrian-American philosopher Leopold Kohr. He was an anarchist and working as a reporter in the Spanish Civil War, and he knew George Orwell personally. And before Leopold Kohr died, I was doing many, many hours of interviews with him, and then I was writing my first book about his life, his biography. So, and he told me many things about his exile in the United States and in Canada, and I came into contact with many interesting people overseas. Simon Schmiederer from Saalfelden, from the town I told you before, and he became one of the designers and architects working with the famous international architects building up the United Nations in New York City. And Simon was living at that time in Florida, and he was married to the niece of Louis Comfort Tiffany from New York, and he was connected to the family of Sigmund Freud, and he went to exile away from the Nazis with the family of Sigmund Freud in 1938 to London and then to America. And then I visited Simon in Florida and did a long interview with him too. I did a lot of research about Austrians who fled the Nazis. I tried to interview them before they die, and they sometimes are still living in my books. So I spent a lot of private money in these projects as a freelancer. I got my good contract with Austrian Broadcasting Company 15 years ago, and nowadays I have some really good money as an editor of the company, but my stories are do not have the quality like the stories had when I was young and as a freelancer. And on the other hand, at that time when I was a freelancer, I never could have afforded to become a pilot and an aviator. So every little thing has advantages and disadvantages.
Across the globe, Gerald had spent many days of his life ascending mountain peaks. A new passion, aviation, came along later and gave him the ability to ascend even higher into the sky.
Do you know Microsoft Flight Simulators? I think they exist since 40 years now or something. And I remember when the first edition came out, it was quite a primitive version, and I loved it very much at that time. You know, when I was studying, I had, beside my journalistic work, because I had less money, I was working in Alaska too as a deckhand in salmon fishery industry in out of Juneau, Aurora Harbor in Juneau. And at that time, when you are in Alaska, you have a lot to do when you're working in Alaska. I always had an interest for aviation since I was a kid or a teenager, but never really got the possibility to get a closer contact to aviators. But even in Nepal, when I was working in the Everest area, and then later in Alaska, I had close contacts to bush pilots, and I had many flights with bush pilots. And it was amazing me so much what they are doing with this visual flight to dream to become a bush pilot at that time. But I had not enough money with my freelance. I had a colleague here in Salzburg. He was a studio engineer of Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, and beside that, a professional pilot and flight instructor. And Reinhard was always a good advisor for me for aviation problems with the simulator. And I was asking him questions. He was wondering very much what I'm doing with the simulator. He said, "Well, Jerry, you have to start to become a pilot. Start now, because you are not too old and you can do it." So, and then I went to flying school here in Salzburg of our aviation club, and I thought, okay, maybe I try it and take a look at it. Then I did the theory, and it was quite, in comparison, easy for me to do the theory. And then I had my first training flights, and I never imagined at that time that it would become such a strong part of my life. I have 600 hours now, and that's not bad for a man who started with 54 years.
In 1997, the film adaptation of Heinrich Herrer's 1952 autobiography, 7 Years in Tibet, controversially featured Brad Pitt as an Austrian Nazi officer traveling across the Tibetan Plateau during the Second World War. Even before the film's release, the authenticity and morals of the project were questioned. Having a wealth of experience with the people and places of the film, Gerald made his opinions on the movie's release well known, so much so that Brad Pitt was asked to step beyond his role of actor to also serve as negotiator.
The whole thing catched me in New York because my girlfriend at that time, it was in 1996, she was studying in New York. And I had spent a lot of time in New York too because of my research about Leopold Kohr and everything. And we were living together in the Upper East Side. And so one day we had breakfast, and I read in the New York Times that they are shooting the movie 7 Years in Tibet in Argentina now with Brad Pitt, and Argentina should be Tibet, because of the landscape. And I became very angry because I knew from many people here in Austria, older climbers and some people, that Hara was a strong Nazi, very strong fanatic Nazi as a young man, and even a member of the SS and a companion of Himmler. So, and I was thinking about these naive Americans. I was working in the National Archives in Maryland in College Park, and I was asking the historian in the archives, what can I do to find out about Hara's SS membership and his records of the Nazi Party, and he gave me good advice, and so we found out the records. And so from a journalistic point of view, it was maybe... I don't want to use the word successful, because when you hunt somebody like I hunted Hara, it's not a success. I had to do it because I had so much work to do with Jewish people and people who were treated badly by the Nazis. And one of these upper Nazis and strong Nazi climbers would become a Hollywood hero again now with Brad Pitt. So it forced me to hunt him down. It had to be done. And some people sometimes ask me, do you think that this is your biggest success in your life? And I always say it's not the biggest success in my life. It had to be done. When Jean-Jacques Annaud, this was the director of the movie, presented the film in Hollywood, the journalists in Los Angeles, they were asking him about the stuff I had uncovered and published. And he was trying to blame me in front of the journalist that I would be a crazy young careerist journalist in Austria. And there was Rabbi Abraham Cooper from the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles and some other journalists. And I have not been there, but Mr. Cooper told me on the telephone that it was quite a big scandal for Jean-Jacques Annaud, because the journalists in America, they became totally angry when he was telling such crazy bullshit stories about me. I was young and wild and free, and it was a totally personal project. I put private money into it. As I told you, it had to be done for me. It had to be done. And then I contacted the German magazine Stern. At that time, it was quite still a famous magazine. Today, it's like many media in Europe, it's bullshit now, because I think internet has destroyed so many traditional media in Europe too. And Stern, they wanted the story, but they took a long time to check all my facts and all my documents, and it took a very long time. And at the same day when Stern appeared in Germany, I think I remember in the Los Angeles Times there was a big article. I produced a longer broadcasting for Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, 30 minutes for our national program.
Ich bin auch Ehrenmitglied in diesen Forscherclubs in Amerika. Und schauen Sie, wenn der Brad Pitt, ich habe den ja nicht gekannt, nicht? Aber jetzt weiß ich, wer er ist. Und da gehen also, was weiß ich, wie viele 100 Millionen Menschen mehr in den Film hinein und schauen sich das Schicksal der Tibeter an. Und das ist mein Anliegen, und damit bin ich zufrieden.
Heinrich Harrer vermutet, dass 1 Milliarde Menschen diesen Film sehen werden.
You know, in 1998, there was the centennial of the Gold Rush. It was the centennial event for Jack London's travel from San Francisco, the Alaska Marine Highway up to Skagway and crossing the Chilkoot Pass to the Yukon River area around Whitehorse and going down the Yukon River all the way to Dawson City and to the Klondike. And I was following Jack London's footprints from San Francisco with my radio microphone for Austrian Broadcasting Corporation in 1989, and was producing a longer literature feature, 1 hour literature feature about Jack London and his travel to the Yukon and to the Klondike.
Tonspuren. Hörbilder zur Literatur.
Wenn das Polarlicht in kalten Flammen über ihnen stand oder die Sterne in der frostigen Luft tanzten und die Erde fühllos und erstarrt unter ihrem Leichentuch aus Schnee lag, dann hätte dieses Lied der Huskies und Wölfe.
It was the time when I was working as a deckhand in the salmon fishery and I was earning money because Austrian Broadcasting Corporation gave me some money for this literature production, but $800 or something. You spend a lot of time and money between San Francisco and the Klondike, so $800 is nothing for it. So I had to work in the States too. When I was a freelancer, I always connected such jobs with journalism. Today I can go to places, maybe last time to Montana, following the footprints of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark expedition across the Rocky Mountains to Idaho. I did a story about it for the Austrian Alpine Club magazine, but as an editor with a contract of Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, I can spend a lot of time with my girlfriend on such a journey and not always working as a journalist. And when I was a freelancer, my whole life was working and freelancing for journalism, so it always was connected. And maybe this even was one reason that I have lost one lady. I wanted to do the adventures on the ones, and on the other hand, I wanted to do the stories. I don't know what was first, the egg or the chicken. It always was connected. Even in the Himalayas, I did a lot of stories in my work as a mechanical engineer for the Sherpa communities. For example, there were in the Kunde Hospital, for example, in the Everest area. It was founded by Sir Edmund Hillary, the man who was first on Mount Everest. And the hospital for the Sherpa communities was run at that time by doctors from New Zealand and from Canada. And I spent some time with a Canadian doctor when she was going up to the little mountain villages where the Sherpa farmers' wives on the high altitude got their baby jars, and she was helping them. And we had to, I was carrying some medical equipment for her as a climber because very, very hard approach to go up to these villages. And some of these young ladies, they were in danger to be killed by getting in their baby. So I did even radio stories about how working as a doctor and a female doctor from Canada in the Himalayas. I was producing, for example, radio broadcastings with this lady, and women in Austria could hear it on the radio how it is.
Die Bergbauerin Dadoma Sherpa arbeitet in einer traditionellen Küche, wie sie für den Himalaya typisch ist. Das heißt, seit Jahrzehnten hat der Feuerrauch den Küchenraum mit einer schwarzen Rußschicht überzogen. Eine typische Rauchkuchel, wie sie zum Beispiel auch bei uns auf Salzburger Tiroler oder auch auf steirischen Almen.
As a fisherman in Alaska, you try to catch them before they go up to the rivers and to the creeks. And you want to catch them still in the ocean. And the quality of the fish is very well then. And the biggest problem are the orca whales and the sea lions, because they want to steal the fish from the nets. And it's quite a hard job to do because Alaskan fishery management allows only a few days in every inlet to fish for small commercial fishing. Small commercial fishing means that no big trawlers are allowed, only small fishing boats with two or three or four people on board. Normally you fish day and night, 24 hours a day, and it's very hard several days after one and each other to fish. And it's a physical, it's quite an adventure. And the first days are quite hard, and they teach you how to open the fish, to slaughter it, and to kill it properly. And many of the Alaskan fishermen, they sell the keter caviar. That's the caviar of the salmon, and it's very well sold to Japan, even to California, to New York. So many small communities along the Pacific coast of Alaska, and even in British Columbia, but more in Alaska, in Southeast Alaska, between Ketchikan in the south and up to Juneau, the capital of Alaska, and to Haines and Skagway, the economy in those small communities is based on salmon fishing. It's very interesting for a European alpine person to watch all these small communities. In the backyard of the coast, you find very, very nice mountains, and the glaciers are going down directly from the mountains to the ocean. And our glaciers here in the Alps, they start approximately at maybe 10,000 feet altitude, 3,000 meters, and in Alaska, the glaciers still are going down to the ocean. For example, the Mendenhall Glacier in Juneau, and it was very interesting for me sometimes to take some money and to hire a bush pilot, fly over the coast mountains with the bush pilot, and in the inland of the continent is British Columbia and the Yukon Territory belonging to Canada. And even the relations between the Canadians and the Alaskan people along the coast are very interesting. I can recommend for hikers to do the Chilkoot Trail. It's the historic hiking trail of the gold rush of 1898 and 1899, where many, many thousands of people were trying to reach the Klondike. And the Klondike River Creek is 1,000 kilometers more in the north. But one of the biggest adventures and the challenges for the whole people at that time was to cross the coast mountains from Skagway and Haines on the Alaskan side to the Canadian side in Whitehorse. And there they built up boats and went down all along the Yukon River to Dawson City and to the Klondike. And following this route and this tradition for me as a European and Austrian journalist was very, very interesting, because as I told you, I come from this mountain valley of Gastein in the province of Salzburg, and we in Gastein have a very old gold mining tradition going back to the Middle Ages. Most of the European emperors, kings, they got their gold from the Rauris Gastein Salzburg region before the Spanish went to Latin America, took much cheaper and much more gold and silver from Latin America to Europe. The 1600s, the province of Salzburg here has been based on selling and mining gold and silver and mining salt. In the Middle Ages, gold was the most important economy in our region here. And when you go to Alaska to see the gold culture of the 19th century there, I collected many photographs and interviews, and even the people back home here who run the museums about our gold tradition are very interested to see and to compare the techniques, how they did it and how we did it here. Interesting is, for example, in the Klondike, this is a very small valley near Dawson City, only 2% of the gold in the ground has been mined during the gold rush. And there are still gold miners up there, and they use very, very different methods to find the gold and to bring it out of the ground. But there is still a strong gold mining tradition up there. I like even the lifestyle of the people up there in Alaska, in the Yukon Territory of Canada and in British Columbia. They feel like independent people. They talk about the United States as lower 48, the lower 48 states, and they are talking about the United States and about Canada like foreign countries. I think many people in the Arctic North of America, they dream about their own independent republic of the North, and this mentality I like very much, you know, as an Austrian, as a Salzburg man from the mountains, I can understand that very well. A resistance against big units and centralized political systems. And the northern people in the north of America, I think from their mentality, they fit very well to the Alpine people down here. It was not only an adventure. I was thinking about to find possibility to escape from Europe to Alaska and to the Yukon Territory, because I was not very satisfied with my freelance job with Austrian Broadcasting Corporation. And when I came back, I think 2 years later, they offered me a good contract. So I am sitting in a trap since that time, because I prefer the contract and the money. In 1990, a Salzburg companion and me, we went to Western Nepal to follow a traditional route in Western Nepal, very lonesome area around Dhaulagiri Mountain. It's a big 8,000 meter, 27,000 feet mountain. And we did not summit on the mountain. We did not want to summit, but we wanted to surround the whole area. And it was quite a challenging tour, about 3 weeks only hiking. In the country, there are no roads, and it's really, really, really lonesome and sometimes a little bit dangerous, because ice avalanches are coming down from the west faces of the big mountain, for example. A mountaineering expedition from Greece, Griechenland, they were trying to reach the summit, and we came into their base camp and had no food left with us. So we were starving, Luki and me were starving, and we had four Nepali porters. They helped us to carry all the camping and mountaineering equipment, but we ran out of food and gas. So the Greek expedition helped us, and so we could spend more 7 or 8 days up there. And it was a plateau high valley up there, and we could do some summits. I was spending 1990 3 months in Nepal. And when I went back to Austria, I wrote a big article in the magazine about the mountain people in Nepal and how they progress, even for the women in the villages, can only be provided if you connect mountain agriculture with a good ecological kind of tourism and bring in some money for the communities, and they get medical care, even in regions. Some people here in Austria, they run a non-governmental organization. It was called Eco Himal, and they called me then, because I was a mechanical engineer and I did some public relations work for Austrian Broadcasting Corporations and newspapers and magazines, if I would join them and help them with their work in the Himalayas. And they were taking care for projects provided by Austrian federal government. And Nepal, for example, for a long time was a partnership country of Austria and Austrian government. And so our non-governmental organization organized, protected several projects in the Himalayan region. And I was working with this non-governmental organization beside my freelance job for Austrian Broadcasting Corporation.
High up in the Himalayas and thousands of miles from Austria, human connection provided community and a sense of purpose for Gerald, always eager to improve the situations of those around him.
They asked me to teach the small mountain communities how to cook with electricity. You know, the problem in the Himalayan villages has been over centuries. They were cutting down their mountain forests for cooking, and for the mountain farmers in the kitchen, for the ladies, mostly the ladies, it was a big problem to spend so much time in a smoky kitchen. The health of the ladies traditionally was very bad when they were older, maybe 30 or 35, and many got lung cancer because there was so much smoke from the wooden fires in the huts. So one target of our project was to build up a small hydropower station and to run it with local people. And my job was to teach young Sherpa people how to maintain the small hydropower station and maybe do repairs, small repairs, how they service and provide the local village people in running their small electric stoves for cooking potatoes and vegetables. The villages are in quite high altitude. Many are maybe in 4,000 meters, so let's say 12,000 feet altitude. Normal cooking equipment does not really work in that altitude because the water is boiling much too early on a much too low temperature. So mostly every Sherpa woman in her kitchen uses pressure cookers. It's the potatoes and the vegetables, for example, even meat get much more temperature in the pressure cooker, and it's independent of the sea level. So the potato in the pressure cooker thinks it's not in 4,000 meters altitude, so it's much hotter in the cooker. And so it was the perfect combination for the Sherpa ladies to use their traditional pressure cookers. They have them since maybe 40 years. The British and the New Zealanders introduced them. And now they had the combination with electric cooking and not destroying their mountain forests. When the mountain climbers and the hikers and the trekkers come into the country, they need food, they need cooking. So they always needed more firewood. And our motivation was to help them to cook with electricity. A big part of my identity nowadays, I do a lot of photo shooting. And I had an exhibition in Salzburg, a big exhibition here in the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation about my mountain photos during flying. About our mountains and everything, and in I had a big audience with this exhibition. In my aviation club, because I'm the only one in the aviation club who is a pilot and a mountain climber, we have many pilots in the aviation club, but there is no other mountain climber. And the combination of mountaineering and flying, there are not many people in Austria who can do this. There are very few pilots within the mountaineering community, and there are nearly no mountaineers in the pilots communities. So my combination and my speciality is to fly and to shoot photos. An eagle is flying high overhead the mountains. They called me Eagle Eye in the aviation club. I had the combination that I am Eagle Eye Jerry now. I think it's very, very important for young people to travel. And the whole ideology, political ideology nowadays, is trying to destroy the possibility of travel. And it's even a big danger for the people in the mountain areas all over the world. I mean the Andes in Latin America, I mean the Himalayas. The mountain people everywhere, they depend on a good kind of tourism. Mountain tourism mostly can be done and is done by younger people. And if you have fanatic climate fanatics who hate aviation, for example, and who try to destroy modern life, we will destroy even the progress, the small progresses in the mountain areas all over the world, because ecological tourism will be destroyed if there is no possibility anymore to go to India or to go to Latin America, to eat potatoes in the Himalayas, to learn to know people in different continents. As far as I see here, even with young people here in Austria, they look modern, they look modernist, but they are very, very stubborn, conservative, fanatic. They have not seen many things in this world. They have not talked to many people because they don't want to travel. They don't want to fly. They only want to protect the climate. I think it's crazy for young people to make them so narrow-minded. And this would be one of the messages of my life. Go out and travel, go out, talk to people, go out to the mountains, go out to mountains wherever you find them in this world, because mountain people, they are very similar, they are very interesting, they are very stubborn, they are very strong-minded rednecks and hillbillies, and very positive people mostly. You know, from the storytelling, for example, my movie about Otto Lang, the skiing pioneer and ski instructor and Hollywood director, or my books about Leopold Kohr, the philosopher, or my research about Simon Schmiederer from Salzburg, Saalfelden, working in the United States as a successful architect. These are the things I'm proud of, you know. I'm very happy that I could do all the research with these people still living, because today they all have died. I'm so happy to have talked with Otto Lang before he died. Today I try to help young mountaineers and young climbers, when they have no car, that they can come with me to the mountains. So I often remember how Peter and Vassal treated us, so I'm trying to treat young people today too. So,
on the topic of regret, American chemist and inventor Charles Goodyear once said, "A man has cause for regret only when he sows and no one reaps."
Not to be a radical pacifist, go to the Austrian army, become an officer, do a lot of mountain sports in the army, maybe become a press officer, have a good job in the army, and then do a lot of mountaineering, and maybe change from the army to independent media, find a good girl and have a lot of time and a good job, and to have children, and not to spend so much time as a freelancer. When I watch at the girls I have loved in my life, it's so crazy that it did not work to get children with one of them. Not many, but such nice ladies. I could have become a teacher or a bureaucrat in a governmental agency and then have children, but this was not so my decision.
Gerald made many decisions leading to journeys beyond comfort into the unknown. In all these situations, he never failed to contribute to the joy and well-being of those around him. Thank you for listening to this episode of If Passports Could Talk. If you enjoyed it, please like and subscribe to hear more from the Bachstieber Institute. Auf Wiedersehen and goodbye.